Welcome back to the CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. In this episode, I'm speaking to Matt Watson, CEO of Fullscale, about the path from CTO to CEO. Matt bootstrapped his first SaaS company to $35 million ARR before a $150 million exit, and now helps companies scale their engineering teams globally. We discuss some of the critical skills CTOs need to develop if they want to transition into a CEO role. Understanding the customer, building a product vision, and mastering sales and marketing. If you're a CTO wondering what's next in your career, or just looking to become a stronger tech leader, this episode is packed with sharp and fun insights, like what 10x developers have to do with bureaucracy, for example. I'm your host, Adam Horner. As a coach for CTOs from startups to enterprises, I empower tech leaders to escape the cycle of lurching from crisis to crisis and build the skills to lead with confidence, clarity, and purpose. I provide practical, personalized coaching tailored to the challenges faced in your organization, helping each CTO shift from reactive problem solving to proactive strategic leadership. I help each CTO forge their own path for growth, allowing them to delegate confidently, align engineering with the business, and fully step into their role as a trusted, respected peer at the executive table. This podcast enables me to bring some awesome playbooks to you and the many CTOs that are looking to broaden their knowledge base. Between me and my guests, we cover valuable topics for executive tech leaders, providing insights, strategies, and practical advice to help you build and refine your own playbook so that you too can excel as a CTO. Matt, welcome to the CTO Playbook. It's great to have you here, especially after we had a great conversation on your podcast earlier on. It'd be great to learn a little bit about you for our listeners so they can sort of understand where you got from, where you got to where you are now, and how you got there.
Yeah, Adam, thanks a lot for having me today. And it was great to have you on the Product Driven podcast as well. And, you know, my career started, I have to go all the way back to like as a teenager, writing some basic script with modems to play video games. Well, they weren't video games online. They were text-based games. Like I started doing this back when it was, you know, dial-up and had a 14.4, 56K modem. Like I started doing programming back then, and dating myself here, I'm not that old, but you know, I was doing it. It was fun. Like I enjoyed writing code and, you know, went to college and was always more of a opportunity guy. Like somebody come to me like, hey man, I need your help with this thing. I was always just very opportunistic and helping other people. And I think I've always been in tune with sort of the communications part of it and helping other people, which I think really helped me early in my career. And I got forced into it in my first job, which I can tell you more about.
Right. So that sounds fun, because I think a lot of engineers start from the point of view of coding and then stay coding. That whole communication, helping, figuring out what people need often comes later on in the career.
Well, I got forced into it because I started doing some software development when I was in college. So the way I started my first company was I was selling computers at Sears. Somebody came in to buy the computer. I asked them, why do you need this computer? And they ended up being a car dealership. And so I ended up rewriting this little database for them, what was in Microsoft Access with a Visual Basic 6 front end. Again, this was like the year like 2000, 1999. Yeah. And I would, again, just talking to them directly, figuring out what do we need to build. Like I talked to the customer. It wasn't really a customer at that point. It was like a friend.
Yeah.
And that's how I really like taught myself to do computer programming. I taught myself Visual Basic 6. I was going to college, but I was learning COBOL and Java and, you know, a little C++, not Visual Basic 6. And so I, you know, was kind of self-taught, and that forced me to really have to talk to the user from the very beginning.
And to use their language.
Yeah. And from my very first job I ever had was working at a ticket broker. So they resell concert tickets and sports right. tickets and stuff. Very small company. And that was my first like professional job. And it was the same thing. Like I was the only developer. Like I would talk to the ticket brokers, figure out what they wanted to build. I built it. I, you know, ran the install shield and shipped them the new version, and they could install it and run it the next day and get feedback. Like I went to the trade shows. I went out to meet with them in person and install the software. It was like a client server app, a Visual Basic app. Like I had to interact with the customers every day. Like I couldn't hide in a cubicle somewhere and hide behind a product manager. Like I was talking to the customer all day long, yeah. Every day.
Awesome. And that I suppose means that you end up with working in their language, their benefits, and also customer feedback when direct can be quite unforgiving, can be quite harsh at times.
Well, and I would say, generally speaking, especially when I was younger, I was a very introverted person, very much a software engineer, you know, probably have a lot of the stereotype personality traits that a lot of other software engineers had. I don't think I was any different, but I think it forced me out of my shell. Like from the very beginning, I was traveling all over the United States and talking to our customers and worked in that very fast feedback loop in kind of a startup mode. I didn't even know what a startup was at that point. Like it was just my job. But I think, you know, long story short, I think it really shaped my career. It forced me to think about what I was building and trying to deliver something to the customer and the outcomes that came with it. You know, I was not as in love with the engineering side of things. Like as engineers, we like to build cool things. We like to build complex things, but it kept me really focused on what the customer needed.
Yeah. Cool. And do you think that shaped where you went next? Because I mean, you sort of ended up going from there towards startups, right? Now, was that your next step, or was there more in between there?
So I worked at that ticket broker, which was very much sort of like a startup. I worked in a medical laboratory for a year or two, and I was the lead developer of that software. And then I started my own company in 2003. So I was like 22 years old. So I worked at a couple places and then started my own company. And same thing I mentioned earlier, like I've just always been a very opportunistic person. Somebody came to me and said, hey, I need to FTP pictures of cars to the internet and basically create a little database to keep track of the vehicles and their prices and descriptions. And I'm like, okay, sure, I can probably do that. And just went with the opportunity. I had no idea where it was going to go. And it turned into a business.
Cool. And that was that something that was very straightforward, answer that one customer's needs, sell it, and then also sell it on to other customers? Or was it more like a development shop where you did that one for that customer and then started, you know, fulfilling other needs?
Yeah, so the guy I started the company with, he had about 15 or 20 different car dealerships he was taking pictures of cars for. And started out, I was like, hey, how do I create this little database for him with the goal of then selling it to other people? And we did. We went on to sell it to other people and, you know, slowly grew that business. And, you know, that business ended up being a very big business eventually, but yeah.
Nice. And so did you have a successful exit out of that business then?
We did. We grew that from 2003 to 2011 to doing $35 million a year in revenue. So it ended up being the number one CRM system in all of automotive and for car dealers. So, you know, in 2003, this was before like AWS and all this stuff. We were doing the racking and stacking and the hard way of buying sands, like all this stuff. Like, and we were a bootstrap company. So we never raised any kind of money. It was bootstrap the whole way. But we were one of the earlier SaaS companies, one of the very first SaaS companies to exist in the early 2000s.
And there really wasn't a playbook for SaaS to follow back then.
No, I had no idea what the hell we were doing, you know? Just, and I had no idea what I was doing, right? At that time, I was 22 years old. I never managed developers before, never been an executive, never owned a business, but I knew how to build products. That was the thing. I knew how to build products. I knew how to talk to customers, figure out what they wanted, and I could create it. I was a CTO.
Yeah, brilliant.
I was not a manager.
And in actual fact, you were the CPTO, if you're going to, you know, really be definitive about the title there.
That was my whole career. Like, I've always been the guy that could talk to the customers, figure out what do you want, and I can see in my head how to architect it and figure out how to go build it. Like that was always my specialty, was like how to give the customer what they needed.
And do you think that's something that's changed over time in general with CTOs, that CTOs are sort of distanced more as a profession away from the product side? Or do you think that's something that's just happened as the role has grown more prominent and more important in the boardroom?
Well, I think there's, you know, 5, 6, 7 different kinds of CTOs, right? Like a startup CTO versus the CTO of, you know, a big Fortune 500 company. Or let's say you're a CTO at a construction company. Like the CTO at a construction company is probably, might be borderline accountant. Like they just manage the budget of what's spent on technology or something, right? Like they're not building a product, you know, it's more of an operational role. And so CTO means a lot of different things, but, you know, I think it really comes down to engineering leadership. I think there's three kinds of engineering leadership. You have strategic, like how do we use technology? How do we build a product, you know, that's very strategic for the business? You have people that like to manage people and process, like very operational kind of roles. And then you have people that are really, really good technically, like they're really good lead developers, you know, they're real computer scientists, right? And CTOs in larger companies can tend to be like people and process managers. They're not really very innovative. product-oriented roles in mature companies, because a lot of mature companies just don't do a lot of innovation. The innovation just slowly dies, and they end up being in this maintenance mode.
Yeah, so it's a tech-enabled business in those cases then.
Yeah, I think a lot where startups are really, startup CTOs are really created and formed are in startups. Like, go start your own business. Like, if you're listening to this and you're a software developer, and you're like, I really want to be a CTO, just go start your own business. You'll get that hard punch in the face real fast, really figure out like, hey, I can spend all day writing code, but that's not gonna help me sell a single thing. Like, I have to go talk to people. I figure out what they want. I have to validate the idea. I've got to make sure I'm building the right thing. Like, writing code is not actually the job. It's figuring out how do I build and take technology I can sell, right? You have to get your head out of the code and talking to customers. And people don't understand that until they go through it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So now these days, you are the CEO, right?
Yeah. So I the company I mentioned earlier was a company called Vin Solutions, which still very much exists today. It's owned by Cox Automotive and Autotrader.com and Kelley Blue Book, and it's all part of that group. But after that, I went on and started my own company, and I was a CEO. And I was built a developer tools company. So I was like, hey, we're going to build products for other software developers. I know what I'm doing. I'm going to go out on my own. I'm going to try and build this thing and do this thing. And learned a whole lot of lessons over a long period of time of like, hey, what does it mean to be a CEO? And did that for about 9 or 10 years or something like that. Right. And now I'm a CEO of a different company. We ended up exiting that company too. But yeah, went from that transformation of being a CTO and eventually kind of figuring out what does that mean, figuring out how to build products, to now being the CEO of a company. But I think it's a natural progression for people that are good as a CTO, and I can tell you why.
That'd be very interesting to hear about, because I hear a lot of people who get to the CTO level, and I sort of see one of two paths that happen fairly often with CTOs. One is, hey, I've got this, I can do this, what's next? And then the other one is, oh my goodness me, this is a bigger step up than I expected. There's a great big cliff of learning and a chasm of opportunity to cross here. But for those people who kind of end up feeling fairly at home in the CTO role, it sounds like that's where you were. And for many of them, it feels like there's another intimidating step up to the CEO role, which has another great learning, divide to cross. I mean, you described it as 9 to 10 years of learning there.
Yeah.
Is it really that straightforward?
Well, I think it's a few things. I think being the CEO of a company is primarily a sales job. Like, it's primarily a leadership job. I refer to myself as like the cheerleader. It's like you run around, you tell everybody they're doing a good job, and you got to motivate them. And it becomes more and more about managing people and leadership. But what really critical is the product vision and company vision. What are we building? Why are we building it? What is the problem we're trying to solve? Who is our customer? It's all the same things that a CTO has to focus on. Like, what are we building and who are we serving, right? Is
so it's
important.
The same problems when you're solving the strategy approach. You're just doing it one level up.
Especially in a tech company. But what I learned is, okay, as a CEO, there's things I'm really, really good at. Like, I'm really gifted at the product part of it. But there are things I hate. There are things I don't like doing. So you know what? You hire somebody to do those. So you can focus on the thing that you love. And even when I was a CTO, what I really hated doing was managing people and processes. Like, I'm not an operations person. I'm a big picture, big vision, idea guy. Like, you tell me the problem, I will figure out how to solve it. Like, I can solve any problem, but I'm not necessarily the person that needs to tactically go execute and do all that. Like, I can tell somebody else, like, here's what we need to do. Just go do this, right? Like, I'm really good at that. I don't like managing the in the weeds, operational detail stuff. And that is very true about a lot of entrepreneurs, right? They need a operations person, like a chief operating officer or chief of staff, whatever you want to call them, to help run the day-to-day of the business. A lot of entrepreneurs are wired this way, but so are really good CTOs. They need a VP of engineering to lean on to help run the day-to-day process while the CTO is more big picture and visionary, even in the technology. So to me, it's very similar.
Cool. Okay, so that step up to you then was, it was an obvious step to you. You took that step up. What were the biggest things you had to learn then in those 9 or 10 years when you were first being a CEO of that company?
So they say first-time founders focus on the product and the second-time founders focus on like sales and marketing, like the go-to-market strategy. And I think really that's the big lesson. I don't want to say in my first startup, we got lucky, but I feel like we got a little bit lucky with that, where we had built a great product and we were at the right place at the right time. and the product really took off. And the second time around, I figured out very quickly, like, man, I totally overestimated how hard it was going to be to sell this. And it was like getting punched in the face every week of like, how do we sell this product? Like, we can build the product, don't know how to sell it. And that's the big thing, is when you're going to be in that CEO role, all of a sudden you're not just have ownership of the product, you have ownership of how we sell that product. And so you have to adopt that mindset of really focusing on go-to-market strategy. Sales and marketing are just as important, are more important than the product itself. Like, as a seasoned like CTO, you very quickly figure out, like, I can build any product. Tell me what it is. I can figure it out, right? Like,
right.
That becomes in your DNA. It's like the Matrix. Everything looks like a code or product. Like, I can solve all these problems. But not sales. Like, that's a really hard one. That's a whole different kind of problem.
It's a whole new level of getting people to do what you want them to do.
Whole new problem.
And, or figuring out what they want to do and then persuading them that your way is the better way to do it.
Yeah. And so I think that's the big leap. When you go from CTO to CEO, I think the product vision, the problem solving, all those are massive strengths of somebody who wants to go from CTO to CEO, like starting their own tech company. But the big focus shifts of like, you got to shift a little more to figuring out sales and marketing and the go-to-market strategy. That's the critical part.
And you were selling developer tools. So your audience were other techies and other folks
that don't buy anything.
Right. Okay. That's what I'm going to ask you. So that didn't feel as though that gave you an advantage for sort of selling to one of your own.
No, I think I was mistaken of like how easy it would be to sell to developers. And then you figure out, you know, they all have ad blockers. They all wear aluminum foil hats in the basement somewhere. They don't answer the phone. They don't like spam. They don't have a budget. They really have no authority. Like, they're the worst people in the entire world to sell to.
Yeah,
and they think they can find an open source free version of your product.
Yeah. There's a joke I heard somewhere that goes quite well. They said that all developers, the most clicked button they ever use is the unsubscribe button.
Well, and like developers, a lot of developers are like really pro open source. They want everything to be free and open source. It's like, that sounds great, but I'm like, who pays you guys? Like, somebody pays you. Like, you don't work for free. Like, why wouldn't you buy, you know, different tools and SDKs and component libraries? And you know, ours was a performance monitoring tool, but it's super difficult to get them to spend any money. It was hard.
Yeah, and you kind of got to get buy-in at the low level and let that roll up to an executive level where they can make a buying decision for something like that, don't you?
Yeah, and ultimately we had to sell through like a CTO, director, VP, but yeah, it was just hard.
Cool. So given your nice 10 years in that, then you exited that, which is a great success. So what was it that made you decide to become a CEO all over again then?
Well, so the company I run now called Fullscale was accidentally an accident. When I was running the developer tools company, which was called Stackify, around 2018, I had like three developers that all got recruited away from me at the same time. One of them went to Microsoft, one went to Amazon, and one went somewhere else. And I ended up saying, okay, forget it. I've got to find another way to build software. And that sent me down the offshore path. So I hired about 10 developers for the same cost in the Philippines and with a friend. And I'm like, we'll just set this up with a partnership. Maybe we know a couple people that, you know, could also use the same service. And then we hired 100 people in the next 12 months or so.
Wow.
And it just kind of took off as its own thing. And today it has over 300 employees. So I spend most of my time on that, but I'm also starting some other SaaS companies at the moment as well. So
cool. And so do you spend a lot of time actually in the Philippines, or do you do a lot of sort of remote work and team management for that?
You know, I need to plan this better. So I go there in the winter, like January and February, and that would be the perfect place to go. But I go there a couple times a year. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. And so what is the typical problems that you're solving with Fullscale then?
Well, for our customers, it's typically being able to hire software developers at like a reasonable, affordable rate that they can afford, right? Like, especially if you're an early stage company, you can't afford to spend $150,000, $200,000 a year for a software developer, and you really need like three of them or five of them, right? It's just the cost is really high. So a lot of the people we work with are growth stage companies are looking to scale up, like we need to hire more developers. And we have some like Fortune 500 customers, even like publicly traded companies, they're just, you know, they also leverage offshore like most people do. So
yeah, a lot of companies now basically make sure they've got a blend of close by,
that's what
further
works
away
the best.
And then completely offshore. So you fit into that model, I guess.
Yeah, and that's what I did at Stackify. I took my local developers and said, hey, you're basically team leads. Each one of you is going to manage, you know, 2 to 4 offshore people. And I told them, it's like, this is the only way I can afford to pay you guys so much money. Like, I have to dollar cost average you down. It's like, this team of 4 people that you manage make as much money as you do. You know, and that was the only way I could afford to do it as a, you know, early stage company that didn't have an unlimited VC budget.
And what is the secret then for promoting engineers to team leads who are then managing people offshore? Is there a secret to it? Is it different from any other kind of promotion to leader? Or is there some special sauce about leading remote engineers?
I don't think there's anything different. I think it comes down to people that have really good communication and collaboration skills. It also comes down to hiring really good remote developers. You know, of course, I've worked with a lot of people that, you know, they had a development team wherever, you know, India, Russia, wherever it is, and were very negative about it. Like, I hate dealing with them. I spend forever trying to help them get something done. And then when they get it done, it doesn't work and I have to redo it and blah, blah, blah. And so, of course, when I hear that, it means like, okay, we'll probably need to fire those developers because they're terrible. But the other problem I hear a lot is you'll have a developer who just wants to write all the code. They want to do all the work. And they really, really suck at delegation. They just suck at figuring out, how do I break down this work? And like, hey, you have help. Somebody wants to help. Just give them the work. But they just don't think that somebody else can do it, or they don't want to, you know, support and manage other people. They just want to be an individual contributor. And those companies really struggle with scaling. It doesn't matter if they're offshore developers or local developers, right? You just have that one developer that like wants to be the hero and do all the work, like makes it really difficult.
Yeah. And I mean, we often talk about the sort of the 10x developer, and they're sort of, I don't know, put onto some sort of a pedestal, these developers that can crank out code quicker than anybody else. But
they exist.
They do exist.
I can tell you why they exist.
Go on in.
It's really simple. If you understand the product and why you're building the product, why are we building what we're building, and you know how to build it, and you can write the code, you're there. You're basically a 10x developer. Because you don't have all these layers of bureaucracy. You're not hiding behind a product manager and collaboration and all this kind of crap. Because that was me. Like, that was why my startups were successful. I talked to the customer. I know what they want. I can go build it today. I can give it to them tomorrow. There was no meetings, no bureaucracy, none of that bullshit.
Which brings us neatly onto the whole topic of product engineering. So if we define product engineering for anybody who's not come across the phrase before, or anybody who's only loosely comfortable with it, then the concept of product engineering is not a new one. It is basically the idea that you understand the product and the customers as well as you understand building software, writing software.
Yeah.
And therefore, as you say, you can jump seamlessly between those two continuously as you work and reduce, as you just pointed out, all of that friction that often ends up between product and engineering teams or people or individuals.
That's why startups are so much more successful and move faster, right? Is a lot of those like hurdles and bureaucracy kind of goes away. And so I host the podcast Product Driven and newsletter, and I'm actually planning to write a book that's related to this. And it's all about this product engineering, as you describe. And I felt what has made my career unique, as I described earlier, is I kind of started in this mode. Like, my very first job, it was like, you talk to the customer and you figure out what needs to be built and go build it. And I was able to always move so very quickly because of that. But in bigger companies, none of that exists.
Well,
it's like the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, it is these days, but it definitely did exist. Because I mean, when I go back right to the very early stage of my career, when I went into investment banking, there used to be systems analysts, there'd be developers, and there'd be a very few who were analyst developers. And they were, back then, the elite. Now, we didn't call them 10x developers back then, but they were the elite developers, the analyst developers, who could both understand what was needed by, you know, the finance side of the business.
Yeah.
I was in investment bank, and by the actual engineering of putting out code, whether that was in C++ or VB6.
I mean, do you think, if you think back, you know, something like Agile and Scrum, the invention of product managers and project managers, did that kind of kill it? It's like you added all these layers of, you know, bureaucracy and process that might have slowed it all down.
Well, I think what happened was that there was an explosion in the amount of software that was created, and therefore the amount of software that was needed. And as we all know, as you start multiplying the amount of software there is, you start multiplying the maintenance costs as well.
Yeah.
And that's when you need a lot of people who aren't necessarily analyst developers to keep a system ticking over and running. And so therefore it creates a lot of work for people who didn't need to understand the product so much, but they need to understand the operations and how to write basic code and how to understand and debug systems. So I think what happened was that the realm of engineering expanded hugely through the 1990s and early 2000s. And I think that's how we ended up with solutions to solve problems that weren't previously problems because everything was smaller.
Well, I think the other thing to consider is, I don't know what the percentage is, but I'll just make up the number. Let's say 80% of software developers work at mid to large enterprise companies, right? Those companies don't do a lot of innovation. They do a lot of maintenance. They chase a lot of edge cases every day. This customer in this exact scenario, this thing happens, let's go fix it. Chasing edge case, edge case, edge case, edge case, right? Now we got to do this maintenance, we got to do this framework update. Like, it is just a lot of maintenance. And there's just, if you work in those companies, you're totally divorced away from the customer, even maybe what the core product is. It's like the core product hasn't changed. We're just fixing these weird little bugs, or we're trying to make it 5% faster. We're trying to move to the cloud. We're trying to save a little bit of money. Like, you're always working on all these ancillary things that are sort of maintenance, and you're in, and you kind of get lost of like, what was the core of why we built this and what we do? That part of it just slowly dies away. And somebody referred to this the other day as in-shitification. It's like, given enough time, like a product slowly just kind of turns to shit for what we just described. Like, you build the core product, it's successful. And over time, like the product almost gets worse. Like, we keep adding all these features we didn't need. We're chasing all these weird bugs, making the code almost a lot more complicated, probably.
Yeah.
And then meanwhile, somebody else is innovating and going and stealing our market share.
And the other phrase I've heard for it is software corrosion. Well, you don't think of software as being something that can rust away, develop a layer of oxide. But what does happen is that the system needs to adapt to the latest new thing, the new strategy that leadership have come up with, adapt to some new framework or infrastructure set that another team that are using it, especially in large enterprises. What that ends up with is a whole load of features and additions added on to the core, rather than somebody who still understands what it was originally built for, being able to go back and question at first principles level.
And back to where we started this conversation, I think the key is, you go back 15, 20 years ago, there wasn't as much software. We were building all this software, right? And in the early 2000s, and all of a sudden, a lot of that software turned into this maintenance mode. You had like an explosion of all the developers scaling. Like, my first company from 2003 to 2011, like, exploded. That product hasn't changed in 14 years.
Yeah.
But there's
still useful.
Dozens and dozens, maybe over 100 developers that support that thing. There were five of us that built the core of the whole product. And now there's 100 people that support it, right? Like, that is the issue we see as the industry has changed. So I think there's just a lot of people that are just like stuck in this maintenance mode that, you know, don't understand the innovation cycle as much, back to kind of where we started, where if you go start in a brand new company, you're in a whole different world. Like, it's greenfield, you're building something new, and it's fun and exciting as well.
Yeah, as long as you don't get the instinct to try and build everything yourself, like we did in the 1990s and early 2000s, because I think these days you can and should move a lot faster by depending on softwares and libraries that already exist, services that are already out there. But of course, that's where you end up with this, accumulation of features and plugging software, connection software.
Well, I'm really excited. I got a little story for you about that. My 15-year-old has decided he wants to do software development. I've always wanted to do it. He never wanted to do it. He took a class at school where he made like little games like Frogger and Flappy Bird.
A proud moment,
Java.
Sure.
That kind of got him into it. Now he's like, you know, Dad, I'm kind of interested in this. And so yesterday we sat down for the first time, cracked open Visual Studio, teach him to do some basic C# stuff. And we prototyped like a whole app in like a couple hours. And it was like, call this API, get this data, call this API, do this thing, add some code, call another API. Like, that was almost like the whole app. It's like sort of assembly. To your point, like, all these frameworks exist, all these APIs exist, but we're putting them together in kind of a unique way to solve a unique business problem. And we use GitHub Copilot to help do it. And like, within a couple hours, we had prototyped the whole thing. And I think at the end of it, the light bulb went off for him. He's like, this is pretty cool. Like, I can see how we solved like a real problem in the world, like building something. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think when you get that buzz of, hey, I can see people who are enjoying this and liking it, it's the beginning of that flywheel of addiction.
Yeah. Yeah. Now the next step is for us to kind of finish this out. And what I really wanted to do is get him to talk to other people, like get him out to talk to people, because he's very introverted, and talk to people about what he's built and get that feedback. Like, I want him to say, hey, I built this thing. What do you think? And get them to say, you know what? This is super awesome. Can you also make it do this?
Yeah.
You know, like, that's the next step I got to get him to do, is, you know, the sales and marketing part of it.
Yeah. Slowly push him into the road that you walked so many years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's kind of fun, but it just goes to show, to your point, like, so much of this, if you're using AI too, like, and there's so many frameworks, APIs, all this kind of stuff, like, you're just sort of gluing a lot of these things together.
Absolutely. But that is, I think that's a lot of it, is understanding what it is you need to build and therefore why these pieces are worth putting together, because ungluing things and pulling them apart later on, turns out that's a lot trickier than you think it's going to be when you put it together.
Yeah, and so the previous company I did a lot of work with, you know, they haven't changed their product in 4 years, same problem. And I built that product in less than 4 years, and they haven't even made a change to it in 4 years. Like, when you have an existing product, it is so much more difficult to make changes to it, because everybody's in this mode of, that's the way we've always done it, or you just have all these constraints, right? Like, we use this UI framework and this JavaScript, it's hard to change it, we'll break this thing. Like, how do you work within that mold? It makes it so much more difficult versus, like, burn it down, we're going to build something new. It's going to be so much faster.
And it sounds tempting. Sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't faster to do that.
And
I always worry that the two big signs for inertia that I come across are, you know, the not invented here syndrome. We're not going to do it that way because it wasn't invented here. And the other one is, well, it's always been that way.
Yeah.
Those are two signs, you know, that inertia is definitely set in. And sometimes starting again is okay, but I find often it's better to try and evolve it from the inside. Is that something that you do with your teams a lot?
Well, as a CTO, this is a really difficult problem. As a business leader, you're trying to figure out, do I continue to invest in this thing, or do I build something new? And then how do I launch the new thing, replace the old thing? And you have somebody like Sonos, who just did this, completely screwed up in every way, shape, or form. Like, some articles said they lost like $500 million in, you know, market value or whatever, because their new, you know, mobile app was so terrible. It was so awful. And they did that sort of big bang where they're like, okay, new version replaces the old version. We know there's problems with it. We're going live anyways. Man, totally has destroyed their customer base.
Yeah. And there's been a few examples of that. There was that, I'm going to forget the name now, but the security company who released an update that shot them in the foot. And that was also no canary testing straight out into the wild.
Yeah. It's hard, but it's really hard. And, you know, almost every release, I always joked, like, when we all worked in the office, is like all of us standing in a room staring at each other going, are we going to do this? Are we showing code today? Are we pushing the button? Are we
sure? Push the big red button. Yeah.
Like, at some point in time, we all get there, right? We're like, okay, here we go. Push the code. It's Friday afternoon. Why not? Right? Like, at some point in time, we all get there, but you want to avoid those big moments, right? Where you're like, if this doesn't work, like, we're doomed. Like, you got to figure out how to slowly, gradually get through those. In case there is a problem, it's like, okay, we can fix little issues. But somebody like Sonos and them, like, they just did not do it the right way.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about in terms of, you know, making sure you take things the right way, trusting the latest technology, going things at big bangs, is there's been a lot of evolution in terms of the way that AI is being used, and a lot of talk about AI. I mean, yesterday we're seeing, this week, we're just seeing the news about the DeepSeek model, which is apparently performing on a par with some of the best ones in the West, and a huge market crash today, 15% down for NVIDIA, for example. I mean, in terms of AI and how it affects coding, how it affects the root of the product engineer in particular, what's your view on that at the moment?
Well, so we just did a survey at Full Scale. So we have like 250 software engineers still that work for us. And here's what we found. About 85% of our developers are using AI coding tools. 37% of them are using it daily. 27% use them occasionally. About half of them use ChatGPT. 40% use GitHub Copilot. But here's the main thing. 42% of them said that their work was somewhat improved. 41% moderately, and 27% said significantly. So, you know, we're definitely seeing usage of it internally at our teams. And our teams are working across 60 different companies, right? So we have about 20% of our customers that, like, won't even allow it. They're worried about security,
right?
You know, code leaking into ChatGPT. Like, some, like, absolutely don't allow it. But we definitely see success, right? And I don't think most of our teams would say, though, it's some panacea that, like, oh, we get 10 times more work done. I think it's an incremental improvement from what we hear from our teams.
So unless you're stopped from using AI for some reason, whether it's policy, whether it's a restriction on the industry you're in, perhaps you're regulated in some way, then you would say that at the moment, if you're not using AI, you should be.
I would say so. And I think from our own studies and studies I've seen in the industry, AI has the most impact on people that are more junior, right?
Okay.
Like more junior developers, it's way more useful to them than is more senior people. And so even with my son yesterday, we were calling an API, it returned some JSON, I need to loop through it and get a certain JSON field or whatever. And I showed him like, oh, here's how you ask GitHub Copilot, paste the JSON in there and tell it, oh, in this method, I need to modify this method to loop through and get this information, blah, 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 blah. I could have wrote the like five lines of code like super fast. It took way longer to tell GitHub Copilot that. But GitHub Copilot gave me five, you know, or six lines of code that did the work. And it was great learning experience from him. But I think for a really senior developer, it's probably faster to just write five lines of code.
Right.
But if anything, it makes us, I think, really dependent on it, you know, which could be a good and a bad thing, where it's like instead of us figuring those things out and doing the work ourselves, like we know, like, oh, I know I can ask the calculator or Google or GitHub Copilot, basically. I know what I need to do and I can ask it how to do it and I know it'll tell me. And I guess there's nothing wrong with that, but at some degree we lose, you know, some of the underlying knowledge of that potentially. And I think no matter what, we always have to be smarter than the AI. Like if I get those five lines of code and I don't know what they do, like it's always going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Like if it doesn't work, I don't know how to fix it.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, one of the things I've heard from other engineering leaders is that rather than using the AI to do the work for you, get the AI to teach you how to do the work so you understand the core principles yourself. So even if it might take you longer to get the AI to do that and to teach you how to do it, that is basically saving the time from some other developer sitting over your shoulder for an hour or two with pair programming, stream programming, whatever, and therefore taking two of you the time to learn that. So I've seen that highly used as an educational approach and sort of rolled out as a policy actually across one company. Is that something you've endorsed with your teams or even experimented with your teams in terms of taking the educational approach?
Well, I mean, at Full Scale, we really kind of assimilate how our clients work. So we have, you know, over 60 clients. And so it really depends on their policies.
Right.
Internally, we use a lot for our internal projects and like interns and entry-level people that we have doing different things. We definitely heavily use it in our training and stuff. It's interesting, you know, thinking about like my 15-year-old who wants to learn to do this. How much does he use AI when he's learning to write code? Like, what do you have to learn sort of the old-fashioned way before you break out the calculator, right? Like, think about our kids. Like, we teach our kids to do multiplication in their head, but they could have just used the calculator. But we teach them to do multiplication in their head because what we're really trying to teach them is problem solving, which we want to teach them to think. And so even as a software engineer, it's sort of the same thing. Like, how should a software engineer think versus what can I ask the computer to do for them? And they don't necessarily have to memorize. I don't know. It's an interesting conundrum. I don't know.
Yeah. But it kind of comes back to the whole point of the product engineering approach as well, where, you know, understanding the customer, understanding the needs and the vision, there isn't really much of a replacement in that. That's not something that AI is going to be able to do for you. The AI has no intuition.
And that's what really got me fired up over the last year and started doing this product-driven stuff that I'm doing, is this importance. Like, if AI is going to write more and more of the code, that means the developers have got to do more and more of the product work. Like, we're all going to have to, you know, up-level a notch. Like, we spend less time writing code, more time talking to users and customers and figuring out what to build. And that's always been important. As we talked earlier, it's like because of how the industry has changed and working in big companies, I think some of that, you know, has forced developers to hide behind product managers. But I think as we go forward with AI, like, we're all going to have to sort of be product owners, I think, eventually.
That's funny because it matches so close to what I've been saying for a while, although it is a slightly different variant on it. And what I've been saying is that at the moment, there's a lot of product people who've been laid off over the last couple of years with all the big tech layoffs, along with the engineering folks. But it seems to me that there's more product folks who've been laid off than engineering folks. And that imbalance strikes me as a surprise for exactly what you've just said, is I kind of believe we need more product people right now, because understanding the customer and understanding what the product should be doing is actually harder than spewing out code, especially with the advent of AI and the acceleration of automatically generated code. So yeah, getting more engineers who are the product people themselves is an elegant solution to that, if a higher bar for each person to come up to.
It's an interesting time to be in this industry, right? And at Full Scale, this is what we do. We help provide excellent software talent for our clients, but always thinking like, how is this going to affect us? Like, is this going to wipe out our business? Like, is AI replacing software developers? And I mean, so far we're seeing tons of demand. We're still hiring. Like, I can't hire software developers fast enough, actually. So there's still a ton of demand, but it's really interesting and fascinating to see. Like, we don't know, where is this going? You know, really don't know. Yeah. Should my 15-year-old learn to code, or should I tell him to go become a plumber? I don't know.
Or become a product engineer first.
Yeah.
Cool. So if we try and boil down the sort of the key points that we've come up with then today. So I think the number one and the most clearly obvious one is understand the product and the customer first, as well as your engineering work as the CTO. I think the second one, which I really quite liked, when you mentioned it in the context of being the CEO, but I think it's just as true for the CTO, which is to delegate the pieces of the work that you aren't so good at and you don't enjoy so much.
Yeah. I think the key thing as a CTO is you got to have that big picture vision. I think it's important. And that's important for a CEO or a CTO. You got to have the big picture product vision.
Definitely. And I think another key piece you said, again, you said it in the context of the CEO, but I think it's just as true for any first-time CTO or founder CTO, is focus on the sales and marketing. It's really analogous to understanding the customer, but at the end of the day, how do you get the product into your customer's hands? It's crucial. There are more startups that die because they build a great product that has no demand than any other reason. So focusing on the sales and marketing is a key point.
And that's not much different at being a CTO either, when you're arguing for the roadmap and why should we do this thing and getting people to buy into it. Like, that's part of the job as a CTO too, is sort of the sales and marketing of, what are we building? Why are we building it? Why am I going to invest all this time in technical debt? Why am I going to move to the cloud? Why are we going to do this? Like, that's part of the job.
Definitely. And another point you had on your list there, which was, I mean, on one hand, you're saying, well, combine these two separate roles into the same role, product and engineering, because it's more efficient. But then at the same time, you're saying communication and collaboration are more important than ever. I don't think there's any world these days where any solo founder, any solo engineer can build something, you know, amazing. Maybe it's possible, but at the end of the day, almost everybody works together. So communication and collaboration, another of your key tips for building a successful company then.
You know, when we have complaints or issues with our developers at Fullscale, it's almost always that. It's like, oh, they don't speak up enough. They don't engage. They don't bring ideas. Like, I want to collaborate with them more. Like, and that's where internally we really train on this, is like asking questions, validating assumptions, understanding why you're building lists. Like, all this stuff is super important. And I don't think product people are going away. I don't think engineering people are going away. But I think it is always important that the engineers understand the why. Why are we building this? The big picture. Understanding the voice of the customer, not thinking that their code is the product. Your code is not the product. The product is the outcome you deliver to your customers, right?
Yeah.
But when you aren't allowed to talk to the customers and you don't get feedback from them, the developers just think their code is their product.
That's a really good mental shift that almost every engineer needs to make, I think.
It is, especially if you want to be a CTO.
Talking of which, Matt, that's been a really, really great playbook to run through. If you were to be talking to, you know, CTOs in their first, second, or third role these days, and you were to give them the one tip that from your experience is going to make the biggest difference, what would that be?
You know, one of my favorite quotes isn't directly related to this, but it's not important to be the best at what you do. It's important to be the best known for what you do. Again, it's about the sales and marketing part of it. And as engineers, we want to be the best. We want to engineer the greatest thing. Perfect product, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's really about being the best known. Like, you don't know the best plumber that lives by you, but you know the one whose trucks drive by and runs the ads and everybody talks about, right? It's being best known is more important than being best in everything in life.
Yeah. So be visible.
Matt,
thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. If people want to get hold of you, how do they reach you? What's the best place to get hold of you online?
So definitely follow me on LinkedIn. I have over 50,000 followers on LinkedIn. I'm also on all the other social media accounts. And you can check out the podcast, which is called Product Driven. And we have a newsletter for Product Driven as well. And that's what my whole newsletter and stuff about is these issues. It's that gap between business and engineering and how we need engineers to have more of this product mindset and become product engineers. So
awesome. Puts that advice about being the best known into full perspective there.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, Matt.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you are listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.